When you need to work quickly and confidently across different apps and platforms, consistent quality communication is key. Whether you're writing documents, emails, or presentations, you need Grammarly. It's an AI writing partner that helps you get your work done faster with better writing. It's always there to help because it works where you work, across 500,000 apps and websites, so you can get more done no matter where you're writing. Grammarly is the gold standard of responsible AI, trusted by millions of professionals for 15 years. It gives you personalized writing suggestions based on your audience, goals, and context, plus tone suggestions to help you navigate even the most difficult work conversations. 96% of users agree Grammarly helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Grammarly. Easier said, done.
I'm Annie Apple, and I'm here to invite you to come and listen to my new podcast series, Raising a Pro. It's the most intimate sports-related conversations you will hear. Each week, we explore the journeys of some of your favorite NFL players through the eyes of those that know them best. From Joe Burrow, DeAndre Hopkins, Myles Garrett, Ezekiel Elliott, Nick and Joey Bosa, just to name a few. With exclusive insights and information, we leave no stone unturned. Subscribe now to Raising a Pro on your favorite podcast app.
HD Smartcast.
You are listening to an HD Smartcast original.
Don't you always want to hear it right from the horse's mouth? I certainly do. I want the best and the brightest minds in the industry to tell me about it. Yeah, Tell Me About It is my latest podcast. Since I come across so many interesting people in the industry, some of my favorite students, they ask me if I can speak to some really intelligent and well-known people on hot and trending topics. You know, like content, influencers, health, branding, entrepreneurship, and more. Who am I to quiz the best and brightest, you ask? Well, I am Siddharth Deshmukh, also known as the Traveling Professor. Maybe you've heard me before somewhere. Yeah, I teach across various institutes. Join me and new experts every week over two parts where we dissect these topics and try to make sense of them. Hopefully, learn something about it when they tell me about it. This podcast is an HT Smartcast original and is available on htsmartcast.com, India's fastest growing podcast producing platform.
As a professor and somebody who's like a scholar, and what a voice you've got, and what a wonderful musician you are. I mean, I it's just words fail me. And then you argue with me, so that's always a good thing. so that's harmony for you. And I've got Saurav, who has been my junior at MICA, which is my only bragging point. The rest of it, he's soared to such heights that we can only dream of, looking at him and really admiring him for where he's gone. I mean, he's just gone within the, I guess, the Leo Burnett group, and then over a period of time, you just grew. And what I found really interesting, because both of us served on a really defunct panel called the MICA Governing Council for Alumni, okay? And what happened was that what I really liked about him was, A, he comes across as a very sorted person in spite of the stratosphere that he's flying at. And also, secondly, he is somebody who's, I think, he has been able to manage just accepting all the challenges that have come his way. So I know how difficult it is for a typical ad agency guy to actually know how to even have a conversation with, say, a Digitas or then a Sapient and talk of product and the rest of it. But he's made that transition, and he's been somebody who's played a bigger and bigger corporate role. And now he finds himself at the start of a new innings wherein he calls himself the biggest possible communication startup in India. It's a great time to start a business, Saurav.
Perfect time.
So I'm just saying. So, now that I've introduced the speakers, and hopefully everybody can hear me, Utkarsh, hopefully I can be heard. But the second thing I wanted to talk about was the topic. So here's the deal, right? I just wanted to hear, I'm talking to two guys who are at the cutting edge or the bleeding edge of where culture meets communication. And I just wanted to get your take on it. I mean, that's the overall broad area of discussion. And I just wanted to maybe start off with a question that I can ask to the two of you, get your take on it, and then we'll move on. So the question to you is, obviously, we've seen this pandemic and we've seen Black Lives Matter and we've seen, I mean, at various levels, we've seen just unrest and shitty things happening and the rest of it. I just wanted to understand whether we know our communication game in the culture that we are now facing, or have things suddenly like changed and we are at a different place. I just wanted to get a sense of it from two very different perspectives. I am happy. This is where I shut up and listen to you guys. Who wants to go first?
Yeah, Harmony, yours. Go for it.
Okay. So, Sid, first, thank you for a very, very embarrassing and deeply glowing introduction. It's really nice to, you know, have a forum like this, I guess, where we're talking about things as they happen. Now, my work, at least some of it, has been in history, in social history in particular, where you don't look at the obvious kind of historical archive or the source. You look for other archives. You look for, you know, you look at newspapers and journals, and you look at women's diaries, and you look at recipe books to give you a sense of a period as it emerges. But typically, the work of a historian, as you can imagine, is always making sense of things in hindsight. Hmm. Where this is different, and where I feel like the method still has something to offer us, but where this is different, of course, is that every moment that we're living through is causing massive disruptions to the ways in which we thought we were able to understand culture. We thought we were able to understand society. Mm. A lot of the structural mechanisms on view have not altered. There is still the possibility of reading this pandemic in the light of everything that we know about how class functions or how caste functions in the Indian context, how race functions in several different parts of the world. That much we get to keep. But everything else, and again, the reason that I start with this is because you mentioned Black Lives Matter and the kind of civil unrest that a lot of us have been in, around the world, really, in different ways and forms, been living through for a really long time. Now, my work as a historian tells me that this does not exist in isolation, that all of this is coming from somewhere. Unless you look at Jim Crow, unless you look at the civil rights movement, and way before that, unless you look at the very formation of the idea of America, the role that race has played in disenfranchising entire sections of that population are not going to make sense to people. Black Lives Matter does not exist in isolation. It comes from somewhere. And it's possible for us to be able to look at the forces that allow for something like this to kick off when it does. But that is only part of what we're talking about here, because if you're talking about something that emerges from a group of people and their communication practices in particular, that is something that we see evolve on a literally minute-to-minute basis at the moment. And there are people at the forefront. You know, I have friends and family, as you know, my little sister is over in New York, and a ton of other family that are based out of there. And minute-to-minute, groups like Decolonize This Place, local Black Lives Matter chapters, etc., that have to constantly tweak and reframe both their entire overall design and activity, as well as the ways in which they're communicating these to their audiences, but also newer audiences on a literal moment-to-moment basis. This is changing in front of our eyes. And I don't know if we necessarily have either the ability or all the tools. And by this, I don't mean technology. I'm not talking about technology here, which is, for me, platform. But I don't know if we have the wherewithal to continually be offering up newer and newer, more dynamic, more all-encompassing analyses, mainly because these are events that have not completely unfolded. They haven't completely played themselves out. The pandemic hasn't completely played itself out, which is why for someone like me, I know it's a stupid thing to say, but a part of me hesitates to offer up an analysis simply because I don't have the full picture. I don't know what this is going to do to us. I know what it's doing to certain sections of us. I know what it's doing, the toll that it takes on different strata of society, but I don't yet have a comprehensive framework through which I can understand something like the pandemic in India, or for that matter, the kind of tensions that, you know, we're looking at, unless, of course, deeply contextually. So I don't have a broad analysis to offer, but I would argue that this is probably a moment to remind ourselves that humility, as scholars, as analysts, as communicators, is key right now, because we don't know, and we have to be okay with that. We can't be in a rush to, you know, talk about a new normal, because I don't know what it is. I don't know what the reshaping of the Indian mind is going to be, because this has not completely unfolded yet. And there was never such a thing as one Indian mind to start with, you know. So, yeah, I'll stop now. And
no, it's interesting. I'm going to take, take a little bit of a pause here and kind of decode it or dumb it down for people like me. I'm a moron, so I try to, you know, kind of. So what I'm understanding from you, and I'm not expecting a response from you. Maybe you can have think about it, because that's the residue that's remaining behind. Is that we don't fucking know, is what you're saying. And the second thing is I don't think we are going to be in a situation wherein we are going to know very soon. And so till the time that we actually have a very clear answer, maybe be a little humble, is what I'm getting from you. Have a think about what I've said. Saurabh, over to you.
Yeah, you know, my sense is, change is only getting accelerated. And, you know, we have enough data points around that.
Yeah.
No surprise there.
Yeah.
And, you know, for sure, some behaviors will change, right?
Yeah.
When you see categories, behaviors around those categories will fundamentally shift, right?
Yeah.
So depending on the category, some you know, behaviors will be more, and in other cases not that much. So if you, let's say, you know, fundamentally take a category like let's say take auto, right? You will see that in the short term there will be a whole bunch of behavior changes, right? So for example, you might find that you might not want to currently ride on an Ola or Uber simply because you're scared, right? Or you might find that you don't want your driver to coming back in the mass transit systems, and therefore you might say, listen, let me give him a two-wheeler so that he can come directly. Now that's a behavior change. Or you might find that there might be enough downgrade which might happen, right, from somebody who's considering a four-wheeler to buying a two-wheeler, right? So I think there'll be some small changes, but I personally think, we are this whole concept of the new normal, we are making it out to be a lot more than it actually is. Fundamentally, my issue, with change is that systemic change comes when the source code changes. And our source code, right, is still, the same, right? It's still governed by this fundamental factor, which is called growth, right? So till the time we are all, that's the defining factor, which is growth, right? Nothing really will change, right? We will maybe move from, conspicuous consumption to conscious consumption. Let's assume, right? So let's assume there'll be a flight from quantity of things that you own to quality of things that you own, right? I can see that as a shift. So for example, you might say, let me not buy 10 pairs of shoes. Let me actually go and buy one, but a really good one, right? But the source code, right, which is what I define as what's really needed this moment of time for us to fundamentally shift and alter what we do, that's not changing, right? So I think we will, there will be a change, but it won't be as dramatic as we thought it would be, right? Some categories will see a much bigger change, and other categories will see a much smaller change, right? And that's my sense of where behavior and therefore long-term culture will play out.
Okay, so let me just push you a little, and maybe I'll get Harmony's view on this as well. What I understand is, things are not going to be that different once things are kind of stabilized with, let's say the pandemic or anything else, right? What I wanted to just explore with you is that, do you think a communications agency, which you're going to start up or have started up, requires an overhauling of its business model, or the way in which it functions, or the way in which it taps into culture. Because up till now, what we've seen is that a lot of the brands that we are talking about in Reverence have begun to fall off on the wayside. Like, for example, today I saw, a Nike being questioned for whatever it was doing as compared to a Michael Jordan, who's like putting in much more money than Nike. And so Nike was being called out for whatever. And up till now, Nike was known for the work that it did with Kaepernick and the rest of it. So I'm just trying to talk with you whether you think from a professional perspective that communication agencies are actually they'll need to change.
Of course, Sid, I mean, like the whole model is broken. I mean, it's a shitty model, right? Yeah. I mean, any model which is an agent-based model is going to die, right? Mm. I mean, you take any agent-based model in the world, right? In any industry, right? Mm. It is going to get challenged by a platform, right? So fundamentally, it's not just this crisis which is going to, fundamentally force a change. The change was anyway coming. I mean, the amount of fragmentation which exists in the industry, right? I mean, if you see some of the functional, some of the real drivers in the industry, none of it is really, we are not really built for the new age, right? I mean, there's a huge amount of value we add, don't get me wrong. I mean, 20% of any brand's intangible value is called the brand. Any company's value is called the brand, right? Strong brands recover much faster than weak brands. I mean, the kind of value we have created on one side is massive. On the second side, when you look at the pressure on the fee, I mean, I keep saying it's a paradox, a huge paradox, right, for the industry. I mean, my estimation and, is that by the end of the year, this industry will have 5,000 jobless people, just the advertising, media, and the communication industry, right? Mm. So the model has to change. The model has to fundamentally alter. I mean, if you look at fundamentally the model, I mean, at the moment, and this is what I call about shift in behavior, right? You might, if you see just the financial model, right, Sid, I mean, 10% of your revenue is something which is called real estate, right? Yeah. I'm not so sure that's relevant anymore, right? Mm-hmm. And fundamentally, you will see some behaviors which are going to get formed. It's not very far away that you will have four-day work weeks across the world, right? Mm-hmm. It's not very far away when you will have, robots paying for, you staying at home, right? Mm-hmm. Those things will happen, right? But the industry was ready for an absolute disruption way back. I mean, just a bunch of glorified copywriters. I mean, don't get me wrong. I mean, there are some production houses which make more money than advertising agencies, right? So how do you really you have to be in the right business. I keep saying that, and that's really where everybody has to finally make a move. And I don't mean whether it's creative or media. I think the whole thing will get disrupted.
Right? Mm. Okay, all right. I'm going to come back to you. Yes, Amani?
Sid, so that was wildly interesting. But also, Saurabh, I kind of realized that at least in the initial part of what you were saying, we're not saying fundamentally different things, because I do agree with what you're saying about the shifts that we're seeing. We don't know if they're going to be fundamental.
Yeah.
What you're calling the source code wala situation. Except that in a couple of little places. Now, again, I don't know if this is something that's going to become mainstream anytime soon, but there's a wonderful economist called Kate Raworth, and her work on donut economics is basically the blueprint on which Amsterdam is now looking to rebuild itself and everything that the city stands for coming out of a pandemic like this. And that actually speaks a little bit to what you were saying
Dumb it down for me. I have no idea.
So the donut model that she talks about has an environmental ceiling. It's literally the shape of a donut, Sid, okay? Right. So the bahar ka layer is an environmental ceiling. More than this, the planetary, it's a planetary ceiling. No more than this, the planet collapses. And under this, it's impossible for us to survive. So the sweet spot for everybody, regardless of what industry you're talking about, is going to be in that little layer that forms the donut itself. It couldn't be more straightforward if she tried, okay? And this is something that I think is going to cause a massive rethink. I know that in the Netherlands, it's not just Amsterdam, but Amsterdam specifically calls it the donut model that they're going for. But in Rotterdam, for example, the questions about sustainability, planetarity, ceilings, etc., that are now becoming central to discourse in disciplines where earlier the paradigms were very, very different. Now, in semiotics, one of the things that we speak about in the course is, of course, the fact that you have different codes that are obviously emerging, dominant, and lapsed ones. But more than that, you have some trends which have a whole lot more staying power than others do. And I agree with Saurabh fundamentally in that this is not the first time we've witnessed a pandemic. Okay, think about exactly one century ago when you have the Spanish flu, and that affects India in a ginormous way. I'm not suggesting that this is the same set of situations. I'm not suggesting it's the same country. Of course, there was no India back then. But the point is that it takes a lot to cause a fundamental change in what he was. And I'm not sure that a pandemic, especially one which has at the moment no end sight. Yeah, we're not looking at an end to this anytime soon, but we're also looking to find ways to mitigate it. And when we do that, what we're rushing towards is something that needs coping mechanisms in the short term, but not necessarily causing the kind of paradigm-altering shifts that would emerge from something else. I can give you examples of those in a minute. And the second thing I wanted to respond to, of course, is that, you know, for a long time we've been saying now that for brands in particular, social activism is the new sex, man, because that's what sells. We've said this in class a ton of times. I know it's deeply cynical to say this, but I believe it with every ounce of my being. Unless making the right noises in this call out culture and virtue signaling, which also is, you know, has its own set of problems. Sure. But when you have people with voice, you're going to see people call out organizations, institutions, industries that they perceive are out to hoodwink them. Nobody wants to think that they're being bested by people who think they know better. The people who think they know us better than we know ourselves. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So for the longest time we've known this, and this goes back to your Nike and Kaepernick wala situation, which I thought was really well done, by the way. Don't get me wrong. Yeah. But it is the new sex. Sex is obviously problematic for a bunch of reasons now, because, you know, we're finally in a place where we're talking about the gross objectification of bodies and so on and so forth. This is all old hat. So what are you going to do now? Now you're going to have to come across as a heck of a lot more societally aware and driven than you've ever had to be in the past.
And let me just ask Saurabh this question. Do you think that this whole damn way in which we have to advertise, okay? Why the fuck do we have to advertise, man? Can't marketers actually find a different way of manipulating minds?
No, you have to understand, you know, that some of the global models, you know, don't apply to India at all. I mean, it's really a shocker, right? I mean, I was a huge proponent of, you know, creating purpose brands. And of course, for me, the definition of a purpose brand is very different than the way India thinks about it.
Right.
India, you have this, what I call the Mickey Mouses of, our society, right? The top 1% who are very opinionated, right?
Yeah.
But the rest of India who, you know, I mean, who's very functional, right? They're very functional. I mean, you take in India, right? I keep telling every client, you just try and appropriate a big category driver. Right. Don't try and create massive, you know, layers around your communication. You take a brand like Limca, right? I'm just giving an example, right, of how functional India is, right? Mm-hmm. And I think we've got to understand, you know, where India really is, because, you know, when you see these global examples, you start feeling maybe that's what India is, and India's not that. Mm-hmm. If you move Limca from thirst to refreshment, it fails. Right? Ah. You start to take it back to thirst, and that's where it starts to work. Right. When you launch an Amazon in the country, you can't launch it on the back of some really higher order benefit. You launch it on the back of choice. Right. Mm. I've got 5 crore products for you to choose from or the cow. Right. So I think we've got to understand that, yes, Asian Paints, you know, does something good. Right. In India, by saying, listen, I'm actually going to give people not just cut salaries. In these, really troubled times, I'll go ahead and I will actually take care of my stuff. And you will still be put under the gun by that 1%. Now, of course, must have a strategy to manage that 1%, right? Because, you know, guess what? If you don't do that, right, you will have a huge amount, right? Mm-hmm. But I don't think brands in India get made at that level. Brands don't get made on Twitter, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, be clear. So, you know, I think you know we assume that the top 20% 20,000 people will actually dictate the fortunes of a brand.
Yeah.
And that's not true at all, right? In India, still, you know, it's very simple. You still need some very simple communication. I mean, you look at, you know, how Modi has managed his brand, right? And, you know, some of the best communication I have seen has been created politically, right? And it's very simple messaging, which is, you know, collective, individual, participation, collective impact, right? Mm-hmm. Very, very simple stuff. You participate, do something very, and you can see the whole of country, you can hear the noise coming from every balcony, right?
Yeah.
You know, there,
no, so it is, look, my feeling is that you're giving a great example, which can be polarizing politically. But what I wanted to figure out from you is that, do you think, okay, so I'm getting two things, and I know that you've studied myths and archetypes, and I'm going to get to you, Harmony, so just hang on to your hat for a minute. I'm just trying to understand, from your perspective, do you see India as more transactional, the Amazon example that you gave, or do you see India as a country that is driven by myths and archetypes?
No, you know, I think that's the problem, because it's not one or the either. It's not either or, right? Mm-hmm. It's and. What I'm trying to say, you need a narrative. You need a story, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, I think our problem is we start thinking that, you know, brands get built on Twitter. And that's what I'm really calling out. Mm-hmm. I'm really saying that mass of India loves a very simple message, right?
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that it has to be functional, right? Because that even that functional message can be done in a very emotional manner, right?
Sure. Yeah.
But it has to be so simple that I know what, right?
Yeah.
So, and I think there is not one India. There are so many Indias that we are playing for, and there are so many segments that we are playing for, right? At the moment, right?
Yeah.
And understanding of all of them takes a hell of a lot of effort. Then, I would say paintbrushing all of them as a single audience. Right?
Okay, so let me just ask Harmony, right? She teaches a subject called Imagining India. So, and I'm sure she's probably in broad agreement with you in terms of the fact that there are many Indias and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I want to ask you a different question, Harmony. You talked of the broken activism thing, okay? Now, what I'm hearing from Saurabh was about Twitter activism too. Right. So in my head, I was processing it as, okay, Twitter activism actually doesn't work, even though we are all active on bloody Twitter and we are active on the rest of not you, people who, so what do you think? Where do you think the communication around activism is broken? Do you think it's broken? Where do you think it can be improved, if anything? Because we can look at it as a project or a case study and you can say, okay, I objectively think, this can be, done differently. Like I asked him about agencies, maybe.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I hear you. No, that's a really interesting kind of way to think about it. Of course, I don't think Saurabh was talking about activism. He was talking more about.
No, he wasn't.
He said
wasn't.
Brands aren't built on Twitter. I mean, I would have to agree with that, and I would defer to what he has to say about brands entirely. But I will say that political brands are largely built on social media platforms, and have been at least for the last decade odd. Like that is pretty clear to me that that's a huge part of the strategy. Also, I'm always dubious, of course, of things that work at the level of an empty signifier.
Mm.
Okay, I think to flesh it out and it's leading somewhere, that communication is downright misleading, if not mischievous. But that aside, I'll kind of get to what you're saying. And I don't use Twitter, and I've mindfully stayed away from it all these years. I've never been on it, simply because I know that it will be far too overwhelming. I understand it's a really polarized space, but I don't know enough about the platform not being on it to comment on it. But I will talk about social media activism in general. I think, like with everything, it can be really useful as a tool for organizing. And remember that when we're talking about educating, agitating, and organizing is a huge part of this, right? And I think anybody from the what they call the Arab Spring, what different groups call the Jasmine Revolution, call it what you will. But from that moment on, it's impossible to deny the power of technology, of mediums like this and technology to drive, you know, just really important things like where to assemble and at what time. And I thought we got a little glimpse of that again with the anti-CA NRC protests when, for example, Shaheen Bagh, the reason that Shaheen Bagh became the symbol that it was able to become, and it wasn't just an empty signifier, was in large part, at least for a huge number of people, and having been to the site and having seen the people who were actually running their social media presence and pages and what they had in mind, I think it became, what they did was they populated that signifier really intelligently. They knew what they wanted people to take away from any engagement with a Shaheen Bagh official post or handle. And then what I thought was really well done, for example, is that a bunch of people, a bunch of organizations, in fact, that came together during that time saw very quickly, because the anti-CA NRC thing bled into the beginnings of the pandemic so organically, a lot of them immediately kind of repurposed, reoriented, and started, because they already had that base. You already had the tens of thousands of people that you were speaking to, and you had this direct line of communication open with them. They very quickly started getting into relief efforts, and new organizations came up literally overnight that were able to work with very specific groups. Now, I can think of, you know, several examples in this space, but I thought that that happened really organically. And I have a feeling that things that the same ephemeral, you know, nature of stuff that stays online also allows us to quickly change and kind of adapt to new needs, kind of adapt to, today I'm giving you information about this, but tomorrow, because ye karna hai, I can also maybe leverage my channels and kind of make that happen. And I thought that was really interesting. So as, again, maybe as a bit of an insider, but also a bit of an outsider, it looks to me like there is a place for these things. If that's where it ends, if all that you do is you know, social media armchair, you know, kind of pontificating, then that's not going to, that amounts for me to less than nothing, to absolutely nothing. But remember, again, educate, agitate, organize. I can also use these platforms to educate. The agitation is on my own time, and then I can use these again to organize. So again, I'm a fan. Give me a new platform and, you know, we will see what we can do with it.
Wow, that was a good one, right? More of where that came from soon. Want to reach out to me? I'm Siddharth Deshmukh, and I'm the traveling professor on Instagram. You'll find the funny side of me there. And on LinkedIn, I'm a little bit more serious, but I'm still the traveling professor. To give us feedback, you can reach out to us on HT Smartcast. We are present on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, Twitter, and YouTube, the usual suspects. To listen to more podcasts, log on to htsmartcast.com or suno naye nazariye se. And join me in the journey. Onward ho!
This was an HT Smartcast original.
HT Smartcast.
I'm Annie Apple, and I'm here to invite you to come and listen to my new podcast series, Raising a Pro. It's the most intimate sports-related conversations you will hear. Each week, we explore the journeys of some of your favorite NFL players through the eyes of those that know them best. From Joe Burrow, DeAndre Hopkins, Miles Garrett, Ezekiel Elliott, Nick and Joey Bosa, just to name a few. With exclusive insights and information, we leave no stone unturned. Subscribe now to Raising a Pro on your favorite podcast app.
Earning your degree online doesn't mean you have to go about it alone. At Capella University, we're here to support you when you're ready. From enrollment counselors who get to know you and your goals, to academic coaches who can help you form a plan to stay on track, we care about your success and are dedicated to helping you pursue your goals. Going back to school is a big step, but having support at every step of your academic journey can make a big difference. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.